Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening.
I'm Will Campion and co-founder of the Money Maze podcast, and we're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment and wealth manager with a purpose to provide excellent performance to clients through active investment management. By serving institutions and individuals worldwide, Schroders serves wider society. Channeling capital into sustainable and durable businesses accelerates positive change in the world. Funding the future is also a privilege. Schroders use it wisely and responsibly. As we know, capital is at risk with investing. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch. Brought to you by the luxury British watchmaker Bremont.
If you were told that abnormally low interest rates and quantitative easing would provide huge tailwinds for higher equity prices, then it isn't obvious you would choose to run a fund whose activity was entirely focused on short selling. However, if we remember the old investing adage that it is a market of stocks as opposed to a stock market, you might acknowledge the opportunity to identify the weak, the vulnerable, the possible frauds, and the simply overvalued. And if you apply the Chinese proverb, hun shu yi mo yu, meaning muddy waters make it easy to catch fish, you might see why my guest today, Carson Block, established and named his firm Muddy Waters Research. So Carson Block, a man who is happy to run against the prevailing tides, a very warm welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me here. A great introduction there. I like that you're basically asking why do this, so...
I have enjoyed the research and I have anticipated this, so I'm hoping that we are going to have all sorts of intriguing insights that you're going to offer, not me. But I read that 8 of the companies you have exposed as frauds have been delisted from stock exchange, 2 others settled charges with regulators, and you've shown determination to root out malpractice, not afraid to take on large corporations, and clearly aren't interested in winning popularity contests. So today, I hope we're going to learn from you about your motivations, your investment approach, managing risks, dealing with criticism and hostility, your firm and fund, the human characteristics needed to succeed in this space, and future risks and opportunities in the world of investing. Carson, I know you're sitting in Austin, Texas, but I think I'm right in saying you didn't grow up there.
I grew up in the New York area, New Jersey, actually. My father was in finance, although he did take a detour out of his career to co-own a couple of health clubs, which were disasters. I think I began the first summer that I spent working on Wall Street, actually, I think literally the office was on Wall Street, was the summer right before I went into 8th grade. So I think that would have made me about 12 years old, if I remember. And my father sat me down and gave me a legal pad and said, okay, so these are 10 Qs and here are the 10 Ks. I want you to break out by quarter the revenue. So I want you to write the revenue, the components of the revenue. Then I want you to write the gross profit and calculate the gross margin. And then these each of the expenses and calculate the percentage of revenues represented by each expense. So that was my introduction to what finance is.
Yeah, well, I think I've been way too soft on my children. I'm going to set them some homework and take a tip out of, you know, that book by getting them to do some sums. But in terms of getting the chronology right, I know you trained as a lawyer, but your first degree wasn't. So just tell me about your choice of first degree and where that took you.
I ultimately became a lawyer. Now, in the U.S., law is a graduate degree. You know, when I was a kid, I was really argumentative. And it's funny, when teachers, they would often say, you should be a lawyer because you like to argue. But I don't know, I had no desire, right? Like at that point, I was, I'd say my father was kind of indoctrinating me in the culture of Wall Street at that time, which was late 80s. And well encapsulated, in my opinion, by the movie Wall Street. So I was, I want to make money. I'm going to be in investing. So when I went to university, I had a really unhealthy attitude toward it because, so my father's background on Wall Street and kind of what I was exposed to was he was not only an analyst, but he was also an institutional salesperson. So it's this idea that you sell. And honestly, it didn't seem like you needed to be a genius to sell stuff. So when I went into university, I was thinking, man, they tell me I need this piece of paper saying that I graduated. All right, this is just a piece of paper. I got to get through this, you know, but I want to make money. I want to work. And I was doing jobs in finance while I was in school. I got my Series 7, which is the stockbroker license, after my first year of university. I opened up one or two institutional accounts for my father that summer. I mean, when I got paid like $2,500 in the summer of 1995 for one sale of stock, it was like, you know, it's on top of the world. So yeah, I had this unhealthy attitude where I just wanted to get out and make money. But something happened along the way. And when I'd gone into university, I was very interested in Asia as an emerging market. So interested from a business perspective and this idea of being early in the emerging parts of Asia, but just also culturally interested. I'd spent a summer or month in Japan in high school, and that really, I think, helped set me on my path toward Asia. So instead of taking an investment banking job right out of university, I actually I'd had an offer and I rejected it, and I pulled out of process with other banks. And I moved over to Shanghai, China by myself in 1998, looking to set up an A-share research firm. And you have to understand that at that time, if you read the Wall Street Journal, there were almost no articles about China's financial markets, China's business environment, barely anything about their economy. So for somebody sitting in the United States trying to understand what it was like to do business in China, what the capital markets there were like, there was just no information. So you had to go to find out. And the way I looked at it at the time was I could always come back and get one of these investment banking gigs, but I would always wonder if I eschewed going to China at that point in time, I would probably always ask myself, what if? So looking at kind of what gives me greatest optionality, I went to China in 98. And I was there about 6 months before I figured out that, I mean, there were literally not going to be investable companies I would deem investable on the domestic markets for at least 10 years. So went back to the States, did banking at a bulge bracket for 8 or 9 months, hated it. And then I teamed up with my father. And so this was 99. So the internet bubble was nearing its peak, but we were focusing on microcap companies, non-internet companies, US-centric companies. And we were trying to take a growth and value approach. We still got blown up by a few companies where the managements had straight up lied to us. One of those companies was a company called Rentway. And my father had followed it for over 4 years. And he was taking the CFO, with whom he was friendly, he thought, on a non-deal roadshow. And the first leg was in LA. We were sitting across from one of my institutional clients that I had developed, and I was very proud of this. And the CFO of Rentway looked my client in the eye, pointed at my father, Bill, and said, in the 17 quarters Bill has been following us, we've never missed one of his estimates. That's how good a handle we have on the numbers. Well, that CFO, Jeff Conway, was supposed to meet my father in New York the following week or 2 weeks later, but he didn't show up at the first meeting and the stock was halted. My father was all giddy. Oh, it's going to be a big announcement, probably, you know, I think an acquisition. It was a big announcement, but of accounting fraud. You know, and then for a period of time afterward, you know, Jeff Conway's talking to me, you know, and, oh, Carson, I swear I didn't do anything wrong. You know, no, this is not me, da, da, da. But he ended up pleading guilty, got sentenced to time. The two people below him, I think, were sentenced to more time than he was. I was looking at that and saying, wow, this is how the world works. And there were other managements that had lied to us and used us during that period of time. But the part that was bothering me was that I didn't know how to protect myself against these predators. And this is at the same time that we were getting smoked by these microcap companies. That's when you had Enron, WorldCom, HealthSouth, Adelphia, so on and so forth. And so that's when I went to law school, because I thought there I could at least get some tools to better protect myself. I really enjoyed law school far more than I intended to. I was there for a reason, and I was more mature. Getting punched in the face a little bit by the world in the interim was really necessary to adjusting my attitude. I was one of the top students in the class, and I decided I would practice law for a little bit. I had an offer with a large firm in the U.S., and I also had an offer from a large U.S. firm in Shanghai. And I decided to take that because I figured that there could be a lot more career upside, especially once I left law, if I went back to China. So 2005, went back there to join Jones Day Shanghai. When I left, I co-authored Doing Business in China for Dummies. And I ended up setting up the first self-storage business in mainland China. And I learned a lot of key lessons during this process. And having been a finance person, I think that inherently there's a hubris in most of us who are finance people that we wouldn't say this, but in our core, we kind of feel like models drive businesses, as opposed to businesses being this organism that produce numbers. And after just the business behaving nothing like my models, you cannot plan a business or run a business from projected financials. Like, the reality will diverge. I mean, especially in the startup phase. So that was one of the hard lessons I've learned. But I also, there was a lot that was China specific. And we were almost out of business four times in the first couple of years. A couple of those times were due to attempted business assassinations. So one of the phenomena that you get in China, especially as a foreign entrepreneur, is you invariably run up against a business assassin who wants to take your business out, usually so they can take it over. And I guess just getting beaten up every day, but not going out of business, I began to see the matrix, so to speak. At the very end of 2009, my father, he'd gotten interested in these U.S.-listed China-based companies, most of which had gone public in the U.S. via reverse merger. And he asked me to help him diligence some of them. And the first one that he asked me to take a look at was this company called Orient Paper, and a market cap of about 150 million. Up to that point, pretty much all of the dominoes had fallen for me in the investment business. You know, I didn't trust the investment banks. I didn't trust the management. I knew the directors don't do anything other than act as sycophants. IR is not a source of wisdom or honesty. Lawyers I knew worked for the management. But I figured that the auditors were actually performing some sort of anti-fraud function. Orient Paper would teach me that that's not correct. And I don't mean that facetiously. I mean that literally. Auditors are not there to look for fraud. They are there to ensure that the correct accounting standards are applied and that they are applied correctly. And so when fraud is carried out at the highest levels of an organization, it's extremely rare that the auditor will detect that, especially for a public company. It turned out that Orient Paper was an empty box. And there were a few small U.S. investment banks that had strong buys on it, and they had actually supposedly sent people out to look at this factory. But the factory was a joke. The equipment that was on the balance sheet, net value of $60 million, was clearly throwaway former state-owned enterprise equipment. If we're being generous, it was early 1990s vintage. I mean, it was almost valueless.
But I want to just be clear, that is because you turn up and you start opening the bonnet or pulling back the kimono, and you see on a site visit what others had assumed was fine.
It was really striking to us because it was cold outside that day, but there was a ton of condensation in the workshop. This is a paper factory. There's water everywhere. Like, you know, and they claim like, oh, we produce high quality paper. No, you don't. I mean, you wouldn't expose it to water that way. They were lacking basic condensation moisture handling equipment. They had just reported $103 million in revenue. And the real revenue was $2.5 to $3 million. But yeah, I remember when we asked the chairman while we were there in the factory, because, you know, sales and production were up so much the year before, we asked, why was output up so much? Did you add any production line or what happened? And he just said, process improvements. And we moved on. Well, after the visit, I'd gone up there with somebody who was a friend of mine whose background is manufacturing, and he was consultant on this to look at it from a manufacturing perspective. And he brought that up. He said, Carson, do you remember when I asked him why production was up so much? You know, was it, you know, new equipment? And he said, process improvements. And I was like, yeah. He's like, you were there. You were in that workshop. You looked around. Did you see anything new there? No. Exactly. Process improvements. So, I mean, look, everything was a lie. And what I did over the next few months was, as a side project, I worked on that report. I didn't really have a business plan. But by the same token, I was looking at my self-storage business and feeling like that wasn't going anywhere because we had cracked the code on how to sell self-storage as a near luxury service to the high income, well-educated, tier one urban Chinese consumer. However, because China's response to the financial crisis was, well, like everywhere else, to cram all this liquidity into the banking system, real estate prices soared on us. And so even though we could sell the service, we could not expand in a way that made sense because we weren't, being that it was a brand new service and we're trying to create behavior change, we would not have been able to price this brand new service at a level that reflected our costs on the real estate. So we're dead in the water on the business. And because of that, that's why I put this report out. You know, there's what I came to realize shortly thereafter was there's a real power when you perceive that you have nothing to lose. So usually, you know, an American audience would understand this. The metaphor that I use for that moment in my life is an American football game. I just took the ball and threw it as far down the field as I could and hoped I'd connect. And I did. I'm literally 1 year after sending this report out to 50 people I had last spoken to in the markets 9 years earlier, the report had gone viral. So 1 year later, Bloomberg Businessweek named me one of the 50 most influential in global finance with like Ben Bernanke and Jamie Dimon and Warren Buffett. So it's like winning the lottery, you know, like really. I mean, you just could never, ever, ever have predicted that at that moment that I sent that report out.
So that obviously gets you focused on this particular seam of opportunity, and you are very well associated with Sinoforest. So maybe just tell us about how you then uncovered what was the catalytic moment in your career.
After Orient Paper, a bunch of people had reached out to me, said, hey, this is systemic. I didn't know it was systemic at the time I wrote Orient Paper. I just thought there's this one crazy fraud. And people threw names at me. And as soon as I started opening up the filings, similar to Orient Paper, I mean, once we opened the filings there, we knew that there were serious issues, overstatements of PP&E costs, et cetera. So same thing was happening as I'm opening up these other filings. And other activist short sellers came out of the woodwork. And it was this weird game that we were playing with mostly retail investors at that time, because retail investors kept buying these lottery ticket. Maybe this one isn't fake. Hey, guess what, guys? It's fake. Here's the evidence. Oh, man. I can't understand why anybody was buying these things after two or three of them were exposed. But we had a particularly bitter battle over a company called China Media Express. Andrew Left of Citron Research published on it just a couple days before we did. He beat us to the punch. I think he published at the very end of January of 2011. We published, I think February 2nd of 2011, and it was audited by Deloitte. So this was the first one of these China-based companies that had a Big Four auditor. And it was also followed by another one of these small investment banks called Global Hunter Securities. And it also had as its largest outside investor, CV Star, which was Hank Greenberg. So he was the founder of AIG and a guy who's perceived as really knowing China. So it was this holy trinity of like why these short sellers are wrong. It's Deloitte, it's CV Star, it's Global Hunter. And it was bitter. I mean, there was at least one lawyer who put up a website telling people that he wanted, if they'd been investors in this, they wanted them to contact him so that he could sue Citron and me. And just a lot of nastiness, like personal attacks really amped up against us on sites like Seeking Alpha and Yahoo message boards. But in March of 2011, that stock was halted. It was halted for several days. And ultimately, the 8K went live and Deloitte had resigned with flying colors in the resignation letter, making it clear that it was a near total fraud. Pretty much everything we had ever said, Deloitte ratified or effectively ratified. So following that big victory, right, a large fund reached out to me and said, we're going to talk at you about this company. Have you heard of Sinoforest? Well, I hadn't. Like I knew all of the US listed China stocks at that time, but Sinoforest was listed in Toronto. And I think the market cap was about 5 billion plus another 2 to 3 in debt. So it's like it had an enterprise value of 7-8 billion. I look it up as they're talking and I'm like stunned by the size of this thing. They go through it. It's been public for 15 or 16 years. Boom, boom, boom. They just give me a bunch of points and I'm writing them frantically down. Hang up. Crack open the most recent annual report, which I think was the 2009 annual report, and everything's jumping off the page at me. What they were claiming about how they paid their taxes in China was just completely, having practiced law there, I knew what they were saying was completely illegal and would have been impossible for a company of that size to do. I realized right away this is going to be a major project. I increased the size of my team, rented an office in Hong Kong at the IFC there. We worked for a month and a half before we put out the first report, and we just cranked so many all-nighters. But it was electric. I mean, that company had been public at that time 16 years, and there's just so many smoking guns. I think we processed about 10,000 pages of Chinese government filings from the various entities. Constantly things are jumping out, like forged letters, forged bank letters, like a letter that was written on, it was obviously a fake letter written on behalf of Sinoforest, purportedly by HSBC. Everything is misspelled, like logo is crooked. Another one from, I think, Chase Bank. These guys have been forging bank letters going back like 15 years. It turns out also that their business, when they first went public in Canada by reverse merger, all there was a joint venture with a local government entity. And that venture never began production. There was this litigation, it was a nasty dispute between the local government and Sinoforest back in the mid-90s. And it didn't matter. Like that had never gone into production. But Sinoforest reported revenue and profits every year from that growing for several years. So from the inception, the thing was a total fraud. And it was fun just kind of talking to the credit and equity analysts who were following it at that time. With one exception, there was an analyst, a credit analyst at Credit Suisse, who was a complete idiot. But other than that, going through our questions with the equity and credit analysts, they admitted, well, yeah, we don't really have a way of knowing, verifying if they own the assets they claim they do. And yeah, it's true that the profit margins they report at 55% for just buying and selling trees without ever cutting them down does seem unusually large. You know, like, I mean, we could tell during these conversations that the analysts were having a hard time explaining the model and how this made sense. And every single one of them, when we asked at the end, because these calls all had them seem like speaking somewhat negatively about the company, we'd ask these analysts at the end, what do you like about the company? And it was to a person, quality management. And I love that because that's such an often heard phrase on Wall Street. And I think that just shows how completely hollow it was. I mean, the answer is everybody who'd gotten into a chair who was looking at Sinoforest assumes that their predecessor had done the work. And that went all the way back to 1995 or 1996 when nobody had done any work to validate anything these guys were saying. Anyway, we put a report out exposing all of this on June 2nd of 2011. Stock fell significantly. The largest holder was Paulson & Co. And John Paulson was at that point quite famous and regarded as super smart money because he was managing maybe about $1 billion or so prior to subprime. And he made, by trading CDS ahead of the meltdown, he made his clients, or he made a total of about $40 billion. So everybody thought like, well, this guy's super smart money. I mean, you know, like he's a bright guy, but they were the number one shareholder. So the media loves to build guys like Paulson and I guess me maybe up when we come out of nowhere. And when people who are built up then fall flat on their face, it makes a great story too for the media. So the fact that I was a complete unknown and upstart, I mean, it just catalyzed a movement in the Sinoforest that just really hit Paulson's funds hard. That was a huge media story. So that made our reputation at that point. I mean, our business just basically went parabolic in terms of the tempo of it and the complexity and the opportunities. So it's kind of how I got here.
But at that point, you weren't actually managing a fund, as I understand it. So then in 2015, you launched the fund to capitalize on this.
It's interesting because I, at one point, and it seems like this has all happened in the blink of an eye, but I was just a guy going around the world with my laptop and doing research. And the business became substantially more complex after Sinoforest and then just continued to increase in complexity. And I'm actually a hedge fund principal now. And I kind of say that a lot of my day is spent principaling. It's not spent like in the weeds of XYZ company that we're looking at. It's a lot more management related, management of personnel and research processes. It's a lot more strategic, which is nice. I've been able to hire underneath me a great team, most of whom have been with me for a number of years, some of whom have been with me since the very beginning. And because of that, it allows me to think a lot more strategically about this business.
Thank you. That's very helpful. As I looked at your website, I see you describe yourselves as focusing on three business strands: business fraud, accounting fraud, and fundamental problems. And I'd really like to get into the process here. So help me understand, first of all, how you source potential ideas.
Some portion of our idea flow came from funds that run short books. And they would say, hey, we think this is up your alley. A significant portion is just us looking for things that seem too good to be true. We've never screened, you know, looking for accounts that seem out of whack, because at least my view is you get a lot of false positives and false negatives because you really need context, my view, to understand why something's out of line or what could be in line in this case, but is misleading. So I'm not a believer in screening. Other activist short sellers, some of them are big on screening, but we look for the stuff that everybody's really bullish about. And a lot of it is for us very qualitative. We'll start reading call transcripts. And if management seems to be just really promotional in its, you know, in their language, then we dig in deeper. But the crux of what we do as activist short sellers, it's really backward-looking research. We're not trying to figure out the future in most cases. And 99% of investing really is thinking about the future. What we're doing is we're asking really three questions. Have management's or the company's disclosures been materially accurate? If no, there's something to do. Have they been materially complete? So the first question is there a lie of commission, basically? This question is there a lie of omission? And if they have not been materially complete, then there's potentially something for us to do. And then the third question is the market interpreting the information that the company has released properly? And again, if the answer is no, there's potentially something for us to do. Now, you don't usually get that third condition being no without at least one of the first two. Best example of the third one would be in biotech. So we shorted a company in 2017 called Prothena. And prior to Prothena, I never wanted to get into biotech because I thought that it was basically, you know, arguing about the efficacy of molecules. And it's our scientists against management scientists. And, you know, of course, the tie goes to runner. Tie will always go to management in that case. But what we learned with Prothena was that actually there's a path in biotech to showing that company is actually misrepresenting itself by looking at how they present trial data. So in the case of Prothena, they're presenting this trial data that on the surface made it look like the drug was efficacious, but it was basically being tested as a third line treatment for a rare type of blood cancer. But when you got into it, actually the response rates were identical to what you would have seen from people who've undergone the first two lines of treatment and hadn't been given Prothena. So there had not been given this drug D1. So that was the sort of thing that we could do where we'd say, hey, look, everybody's bulled up on this trial data, but honestly, this does not show efficacy. It took a while for that one to work out. They eventually pulled the plug on D1 and the stock crashed. So redemption took a little while with that one.
We had Mark Mobius on the show about a year ago, and he said that one of the things that he'd learned, I think, firsthand in terms of mistakes was where in developing markets, a very wealthy principal had lots of interest in lots of different businesses and the potential to move assets around. Are there some activities or markers that you look for in management teams that make you extra vigilant?
Well, so Mobius was obviously referring to EMs and FMs. And so I take a different view of those often than I do if I see something similar in the States. So for or another developed market. But when looking at something that's an EM or FM company, when you see the chairman or controlling shareholder moving things around, and just so many times I've heard the answer, you know, when we or others would ask, like, well, gee, you know, if this is so great, why wouldn't you be doing it at the company that you wholly own that's private, but you're doing it in the public company? And yeah, like the NMC Health was a great example. This, oh, well, we want to share the fruits of this with the public because we're bullshit. You ever hear somebody saying that from an emerging or frontier market? I mean, even developed market. Sorry, that's not, no. They don't want to share the fruits with the investing public, okay? That's one of the things. When we see things being moved around a lot with EM, FM companies or and the controlling shareholders, hands in different pies, we get really suspicious, especially if we see transactions between the listed company and those other companies. And I mean, so often what we find is that those other companies are there to flatter the profit margins, reported profits of the list co.
So in doing my research for this call, I had a conversation with Chris Dale. He runs Kintbury Capital, which is a Euro long short fund that I happen to be invested in. And he raised a question that I thought was intriguing, so I want to ask it of you, which is how telling is the response you get from managements when you've published negative research on them?
I used to think it was quite telling. You can tell when you've cut close to the bone, because if you get this really fast, just nasty reaction of, oh, we're going to file complaints with the regulators and look at suing them, you could tell that you've hurt them. But the more sophisticated companies don't really engage in that, to be honest. I mean, more sophisticated in terms of understanding how to deal with criticism. Doesn't mean that you haven't cut them and doesn't mean that they aren't freaking out internally. But the thing that one of these companies has to contend with in that situation is as soon as we or another short activist publish, the companies are just hit by all these crisis communication firms. And the crisis communication firms want to sell basically the exact same template, which is go back at them hard, ad hominem, point out that they're short sellers and take any little thing that they didn't necessarily nail down, distort it, make it look like it's super significant. And, you know, and that honestly is counterproductive because you get to a point where for us, this is a business. We've seen it all. But then you get our blood pumping. And then it's like, okay, You want to make it seem like we made stuff up. You're going to say that we're lying, we're manipulating. All right, buddy, it's on. So I think that's one of the reasons companies shouldn't do that. So the short answer to your question is, it's not entirely telling because some companies just know how to handle it today better than others do. But certainly when you see the fire and brimstone response within a few hours of the initiation, you know you've heard that in terms of not just because the stock fell, but in terms of getting at their vulnerabilities, the things they try to conceal from the investing public.
But frauds, of course, are only one part of the short universe. And as you distill that opportunity set, how do you think about the other shorts that you want to do work on?
Well, the vast majority of what we publish on these days from a legal perspective is probably not fraudulent, or at least based on what we can access, we couldn't say it's fraud. Here's like a fundamental problem with Western societies, with liberal democracies today. And I kind of suspect that almost everybody has to feel this in their bones in some way. You can massively violate the spirit of the law without violating the letter of the law. You can stay just on the right side while obviously doing things that the law is intended to prohibit. And that is what we mostly do. We expose legal accounting maneuvers that obscure the economic reality of the business. That's most of what we do. The reality is, in my business, if you can use the F word, the fraud word, if it's a fraud, that's usually good for investors to react more to that and they care more about it.
So that leads us nicely into the geographical question. You've been successful with Chinese-based companies, even if they're listed in the US. You've had a go in Europe, and I think, and you'll clarify in a minute, maybe the German response was quite strong. But it just made me think that are the regulators here in Europe and other places looking through the lens the wrong way?
So if we're talking about situations where management is using largely legal maneuvers to manipulate financials, there's nothing for regulators to do there. If we're talking about fraud, so similar to how everybody misunderstands the role of auditors, I think a lot of people, particularly on the back end of a stock implosion, misunderstand the role of regulators. Okay, regulators in a proper market are not there to spot the frauds and the problems before they go public. Their role is to ensure that there's adequate disclosure and that the companies are adhering to the disclosure standards. But when there is wrongdoing, their role is to prosecute that wrongdoing. And by having a strong enforcement regimen, deter future wrongdoers. That's how regulation is supposed to work. There's another proverb in China, kill the chicken to scare the monkey. That's basically how functional regulation is supposed to work. Now, we have this problem in which regulators are so overmatched now. This is maybe a little bit overly cynical, but I feel so often when regulators at almost any level of the government are talking to the companies they regulate or the law firms representing them, that the individuals at the regulators are basically interviewing for their next job. You know, so you have this built-in disincentive to really enforce against anybody. And also in the US, there was a sense after Enron in which, you know, they put not only Enron out of business, but they put Arthur Andersen, the audit firm, out of business. There was a sense that the US government had overreached there and that they needed to dial it back a little bit. I mean, I don't have an opinion as to whether they overreached. I don't know that they really did by much, if they did. The vast majority of what Enron did was actually not illegal. A lot of people misunderstand what Enron was and what it wasn't. People will say, oh, huge fraud, Enron. Not the vast, 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 vast majority. So I actually came to know Andy Fastow a little bit a few years ago. And first time I sat down with him, he was explaining how they used what they called total return swaps, a little bit different from the TRSs that we use in my business. They used TRSs and some other derivatives to borrow money, but in a way that made it appear as though it was operating cash inflows, so revenues. And look, the banks were completely complicit in this. If you Google Mahonia, I believe, so Mahonia and Enron, like, you'll get a description of one of these structures. And this was legal. When Andy explained this, I said, how big an impact did this have on your financials? He said, well, I think in the year 2000, which was the last full year for which we reported, we generated about $4 billion of operating cash flow that was really financing cash flow through the structure. And we ended up reporting operating cash flow that year of $4 billion. And again, this was legal. Nobody was prosecuted for this. Because Enron was such a major political event, how could this large company collapse? The DOJ went in there and they ended up finding, I think, a handful of relatively small frauds that didn't move the needle that much. And that's what they prosecuted guys like Fastow and Jeff Skilling on and got convictions. So the problem is the DOJ felt they overreached after that. And that message eventually was well received by corporate America, and I would argue corporate Europe, particularly after the financial crisis, where it's like, oh, these are employers, don't mess with them. And they've got lots of cheap debt to play all these games with. I think that's the problem, that when you actually do have legal violations, there isn't a real appetite to enforce, especially if these are hard cases. Jesse Eisinger, who's a journalist, investigative journalist in the U.S., writes for ProPublica. He wrote a book that was published, I think, 2 years ago called The Chicken Shit Club. And it's about this exactly, where the U.S. Department of Justice, they just don't want to take hard cases. And it was actually Jim Comey who, I think, branded the people in the Southern District of New York, who the prosecutors who'd never lost a case. You know, his first day there, Comey apparently went in and asked for a show of hands, you know, who's never lost a case? And the hands that went up, these people were all proud, like, man, like, I've never lost a case. Comey said, yeah, my friends and I call you the chicken shit club. You haven't lost a case because you're afraid to take hard cases.
Let's talk about risk, because we all understand the asymmetry where you can be long a stock and it can go up a multiple, but the defined downside and a short and the difficulty of adding to a short as it's working. How do you think about risk and what have you learned from your experiences?
When I was working with my father and I decided to leave back in 2002, one of the other dynamics that was going on, and we were long side only, but I was always wanting to exit a stock at the first sign of a problem, or especially because I'd been burned by bad management. But as soon as the hairs on the back of my neck started to stand up, I wanted to get out of stocks. And my father at that time, pretty funny, he said, you know, you're much more conservative than I am. Of course, he would never, ever, ever have undertaken this business model. So it's not that, it's just that when it comes to risk, I've always preferred to be too early to close a position than too late. I mean, look, with activist short selling, there's definitely a different dynamic than with non-activist short selling. Non-activist short selling has been, unfortunately, awful since the financial crisis. And the vast majority of people who ran short-only, short-biased funds have gone out of business since the GFC. And those who are still around, I mean, their assets are a shadow of their former selves. So activist short selling can thrive, but the issue is that it's not a very scalable strategy. We returned some capital earlier this year because we'd been compounding it for a few years, and we just felt like the tail was starting to wag the dog, where we were looking at potential shorts based on their trade capacity as opposed to what should we really be out there shorting. So look, that said, I've always been too quick to close. And so we brought in some data scientists to develop an AI to try to advise us on when to close. Because the idea was that, okay, if we start overruling our human judgment here, and you know, maybe there are signals that AI can detect as to when a stock really is going to sustainably get up off the canvas versus it being just a blip. We're now running a strategy utilizing that to advise us on when to close. So we've got the human element of let's be really quick on the trigger at the moment. We feel like things are getting a little risky. We've got that. And then we've got the, look, we've disclosed this to investors. We're going to leave positions, generally leave them on until this AI thing says, hey, get out of it. We have to keep positions trimmed. And that's the hard part when you think about things from a logical perspective.
Carson, let's talk about what must be very tricky when you've got a conviction short on and you get one of these irrational squeezes. Just tell me how you manage that.
Well, mean, there's no great way of managing that. Last year, there were some things that really moved against us, and it happened very quickly. The problem that we had was we don't sit there and stare at the screen all day, because trading is a form of fast thinking. Research is a form of slow thinking. And we were just getting slammed by volatility, especially in this one company, GSX, that turns out had been squeezed up by that guy, Bill Huang, who his arch ego's family office that took $20 billion in capital and saw fit to lever to $100 billion, blew up. He was squeezing it along with some others. So we hired somebody full-time to be a trader last August as a result of that. And just to make sure that we're told as soon as something starts ripping, hey, it's going up. And to answer your question, though, I mean, although this sounds counterintuitive, you have to understand that when you're on the short side, it's all about risk management. So when things go up, we decrease sizing. As they go down, then we size back up. But that part's really the harder decision, harder set of decisions, the resizing than decreasing risk. We've seen enough people on the short side, seen lots of people go out of business since 2009. So the main thing is just don't go out of business.
And of course, GSX turned out to be a fraud, and I am assuming that you made money out of it in the end. Is there great value in postmortems when you look at the shorts that have not worked, in terms of, are there many lessons you have learned along the way?
Yes, we do postmortem when things don't go well. And then we also, over the long term, look at it. And we learned back in 2017, we really got into looking at factors as opposed to just like beta, you know, or as opposed to index performance to explain the performance of some of our shorts. So we had been short this company called OSI Systems, and we shorted that in late 2016. And as of, I think, mid-2017, it was looking like a good short for us. But then when we started understanding, and we did this with one of our counterparties, they were talking with us about factors. These are individual components that could be driving or that drive the returns of the stock price. So say momentum would be one, or global mid-cap telecom. We look back, we see how the names have performed relative to factors, and we try to figure out what went, and more often what went wrong. We don't usually sit around actually and ask what went right.
I think most people would rightly in the investing business say that short alpha is harder to achieve than long alpha, and people feel, even hedge fund managers who practice it, feel less good about it. What do you think are the three skills you need to be an effective short seller who goes the distance?
Wow. Well, so we're talking non-activist here. So long short manager with a short book. Number one, numbers one through three are risk management. The problem with answering that question is that I know so many of the serious short sellers, many of whom either just really no longer have a short book effectively or have gone out of business, and they're not wrong in their theses. The problem is companies in this ultra low rate environment, companies have just been able to string their demise out for much longer. So prior to the global financial crisis, you had these most of the time when you're going to short a stock, especially for fundamental reasons, and you're not an activist, you are thinking about the catalyst. Okay, so here's my thesis. What will catalyze this thesis and create the sell-offs? And it's usually going to be earnings, right? So you're thinking, okay, this is the quarter that the wheels are going to fall off. They're not going to be able to hide the deterioration in the profit margins, blah, blah, blah. Well, that used to be short sellers who were reasonably good at the timing element before the global financial crisis. But the problem is following the GFC, so many of these companies where you think the wheels are going to fall off, well, they just borrow a bunch of money. They go on an acquisition binge. They just muddle their financials and nobody can tell what's really happening in the core business. You know, everything becomes like one-time expense. And so the theses have generally been correct. The timing, if you look at Wirecard, people, I think, started shorting that a little bit before the global financial crisis. That took 12 years to play out. Now, to be fair, the state of Germany protected the company for a while. So if you take that factor away and you're in a more functional country, it probably wouldn't have lasted as long. But the number one thing you need to do, position sizing. Okay. So that's risk management perspective. You really just need to have a large number, call it 50 plus little positions on the short side. And that way, if any of them just start ripping on you in idiosyncratic fashion, it's not going to kill you. And if it's market beta, then you need to have a long book somewhere to hedge that out.
So the elephant in the room here is Tesla. And you've written Charlatans versus the Musks. If I've understood it, you've owned the bonds and used the coupons to buy the puts. Lots of us, myself included, have been wrong on Tesla. Where did we go wrong?
Well, I call it right but wrong. Okay. And almost the entire time that Tesla has been public, I and my firm have bought into the thesis that it's non-economic business. It's going to hit the wall. But again, we recognize the star power of Elon Musk. So we didn't want to be short this in a way where our downside was unlimited. So that's why we created that capital structure arbitrage trade where we were long the bonds and bought long dated deep out of the money puts that almost paid off. But yeah, what went wrong here? Well, the idea that Tesla could economically produce these cars and outcompete the world's largest auto manufacturers seems ludicrous because Tesla does not have the manufacturing base, the sales base, et cetera. But what I recently came to realize, the only scale that really mattered for Tesla was the scale of its capital base. And through a combination of extremely low, well, you know, now negative real interest rates and showmanship, Tesla achieved a massive capital base and it raised money. And even if the stock completely falls apart, I mean, right now its enterprise value is almost double that of Toyota. It can raise so much money on the way down that it has all the scale it needs to survive for a long time producing in a non-economic business. Now, a lot of people jump on me when I say it's non-economic because they'll say, oh, yeah, but look at the profit. Yeah. Strip away the subsidies, strip away the accounting games. It's not an economic business, but that does not matter. And so when I really came to that revelation, it was after waking up in the middle of the night with this, you know, it's almost like a nightmare for a short seller. And look, I believe in decarbonizing the economy. I mean, in the sense that I do not believe in continuing to watch the world burn. But in order to decarbonize, I think Tesla is really the blueprint because without those ultra low rates, you know, negative or near zero to negative real rates, Tesla wouldn't pulled off what it has. So I believe that it will eventually become the express policy of the world's major central banks, and maybe the Fed last here, but to keep rates, real rates near or below zero in order to effectively subsidize through a quasi-market manner, development of technologies and infrastructure to decarbonize the economy. So when you think about it, Tesla's really the blueprint. It's hard to say with a straight face, but it's true that this is really the blueprint for success for how to develop businesses that will help us decarbonize the economy in the decades to come, if we're going to do it.
And the central banks are probably the ultimate water muddiers in this whole process. And so that leads me to the next question, which is, if we are going to see the financial repression, which we've seen after Napoleonic Wars, Second World War, where these zero rates, negative real rates, persist much longer than anyone could have imagined, shorting stocks is going to require immense patience. And I know people like Bill Ackman have referred to you very favorably with your very thorough research and your great detail that you attend to. But have you got the staying power?
I think you have to differentiate, as I long have, activist short selling from that traditional short selling. There's been tremendous evolutionary pressure on short selling since the financial crisis. And short sellers have had to evolve or die. And the vast majority have died. Almost everybody who is not an activist short seller has died off. So with all due respect to the two friends I have who are still short sellers and not traditional short sellers, I don't think that that's a viable model absent activism. When I think about Tesla and I juxtapose that against a company we shorted earlier this year, SPAC called XL Fleet, or some companies that were also these SPAC empty boxes like Lordstown and Nikola that Hindenburg Research, which is another activist short seller, shorted. If you look at this and say, well, to successfully short these companies as activists, you need to really understand technology, I think you'd be wrong. In American, we have a phrase called playing the man, not the ball. And so I think that the technology is the ball, but you play the person. And so we look for behavioral cues or clues as to how real the people behind it are and how real the company is. If you look at Nikola, I mean, you rolled a truck down a hill and filmed that as a promotional video. I think the CTO, it was the brother of Trevor Milton or something like that, and his last gig had been pouring concrete in houses. Like, you don't need to be a technological genius to know that this company likely does not have what it needs to take the next step. So I think that when it comes to these kinds of stocks, you don't short the Elon Musks because they build the cars. Elon has made lots of predictions about the future that he must know not too far from the front of his mind are not realistic, but he delivers on enough of the significant promises, the high level promises. I'm going to build the car. I built the car. I'm going to build the rocket. I built the rocket. That he's not the guy you short. So the zero or negative real rates really would be designed to encourage more of the Elon Musks to develop. But you're going to have so many charlatans. We'll have such a ratio of charlatans to Elon Musks that there will be a great environment to short as an activist those companies that are just never going to actually build a car, build the rocket.
So let's talk about going long versus going short. I read that you acquired shares in, I think it was GT Gold Corp. It went up four times. The work that you do is forensic and detailed, and you have all of the skill sets to run long as well as short. I heard you've been tempted to run a long fund in Asia. Briefly, will you want to run long money as well?
I don't want to run long money competing with everybody else who's doing the same thing. It's not intellectually interesting. Our business is built on information asymmetries. And so when you looked at this junior gold miner, that's a great example of where you can have significant information asymmetries because 90 some odd percent of listed junior gold miners are scams. If you can figure out one that actually has like a real deposit and can actually be commercialized, and there, you know, other factors as well in mine development, then, and it's hard to do that. But if you can do that, that's an example of a way that you can very profitably exploit information asymmetry on the long side. So we like that. We are getting ready to open an office in Vietnam. I've been very negative on China for well over a decade, just in terms of my view about the future of the society, the quality of its government, the quality of its companies and corporate governance. And I think it's a malign influence in the world. So what we have this macro view that doesn't really take a genius to see this one, but that a lot of incremental FDI is going to be directed away from China. And that was the case even before COVID, but on the back end of COVID, that's going to be even more so. There are going to be markets that really benefit from this. And I think ground zero for the benefit, you know, at least in terms of new FDI dollars relative to the size of the economy, is going to be Vietnam. So we're looking to launch a long product at some point that's based on this macro thesis. It'll be focused on Vietnam, but we'll be long companies, you know, elsewhere in the world. I mean, maybe even some in the US for reshoring type plays. But I don't go through life thinking that I have to hate everything. I just go through life thinking that it's more fun to hate everything than it is to like everything.
Okay, Carsten, I'm going to ask you five questions, but I want short answers, please. Bitcoin, long or short?
It's tulips. I have no opinion.
We'll take that as a neutral. What advice would you give to a 20-year-old Carsten Block?
20-year-old Carsten Block or 20-year-old, like, you know, student who wants to go into finance?
Either.
ultimately understand how you're really built as a person. And I'm very cynical. I was always very outspoken. I got in a lot of trouble. And if you are somebody who doesn't, for whatever reason, really fit in, there's probably a way for you, if you're interested in finance, probably a way for you to come up with a business model or a niche built on that. So if you feel like you're kind of a misfit, spend some years getting the tools that everybody else has, but think about really how to try to craft a niche that's built around your idiosyncrasies.
Your favorite film and your favorite piece of music?
That's hard to say, but I really like Wag the Dog.
Gotta watch that. Haven't seen that.
You haven't seen that?
Nope.
It's got a great cast, but it's basically about a fake war to try to bail out a president from a scandal, a sex scandal. Favorite piece of music? I mean, it depends, but I guess I spend most of my time listening to 90s gangster rap. It's a good filter for viewing, like the kind of
it helps you when you're looking at your Chinese shorts. And I know that you can bench press 300 pounds, which is a multiple of my weight. But what else do you do in your spare time that gives you therapy?
Well, the reason I'm lifting weights is because you can pretty much do it as well at 45 as you could when you were 25. So, I mean, I've got a couple kids and, you know, most of the free time is spent trying to keep them entertained and keep them from becoming degenerates. So a very normal, boring life outside of work.
And maybe drinking a little wine when you're in your home in Sonoma, I guess.
Yeah, well, actually, you know, I'm a wine guy, but having lived an expat life in Asia for a while and also having grown up in the northeastern United States, where if it's winter, you've got nothing to do but drink. If it's summer, you're going to celebrate and drink. So I've put a lot of miles on my liver at a relatively young age. So my doctor keeps telling me like, no more than 8 drinks a week, 3 drinks per sitting, which puts me at just over half a bottle of wine, which kind of sucks because now I can actually afford good wine.
Yeah, maybe if you come to London, we'll break some of those rules for one night. And finally, Carsten, because you've been very generous with your time, what would you like your legacy to be?
I'm fond of saying that nobody's going to remember any of this years from now. When I think about my legacy, I think about my kids. I want to prepare them for a world that I think is going to be a lot harder than the world you and I graduated into. At the end of the day, the thing that I guess I'd really want to be known for is being able to take a bunch of punches and get back up off the canvas and go at it. To me, that's, I think, the number one skill or trait that you need in this world. And it's actually, you find it in shorter and shorter supply every day in the West anyway. The guys in China and Russia certainly don't have that in short supply. But here in the West, I think we're going soft. So I would like to make sure my kids are not soft.
Well, Carsten, I'm going to let you go, but I'm going to just say two things that I take from this conversation. One is your obvious humility. It's not always found in finance, even if one is strongly opinionated. So thank you for showing that. And that pick yourself up off the canvas, which is somebody else's definition of success, was when you hit the ground for failure, how high you bounce afterwards. So I think that is really important, that resilience, put another way. Carsten, good luck with your ventures and your success going forward. You've had a terrific track record, I should say, in what you've been doing. So good luck with being able to maintain that. And we hope to see you in London.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Simon.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.